You've heard of waterboarding, but how about music boarding? You've got a cute way of talking. We'll tie a yellow ribbon around the old Muskrat Susie, Muskrat Science. A singer in a smoky room. You're beautiful. You're beautiful. We can dance if we want to. We can leave your friends behind. Make it stop. With all its experience interrogating taciturn detainees, the CIA apparently has a music torture playlist. Government officials who get paid to play really bad music over and over again? I guess they never heard of Top 40 AM radio. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, July 15th, and it's true, believe it or not, reportedly the CIA uses certain songs to get detainees to talk. More coming up. GM has a big announcement this morning. What is the largest U.S. auto company up to? Thoughts on luck and luckiness. Also today, Barack Obama's speech to the NAACP and President Bush okays offshore oil drilling. We look at the politics and the policy. That and all the news. Today in Iraq, police say a double suicide bombing has killed at least 28 people and wounded more than 50. Reports say the bombers blew themselves up in a line of army recruits in Bakuba, about 40 miles north of Baghdad. General Motors CEO Rick Wagoner is expected to announce major cost-cutting efforts just about an hour from now. The restructuring plan is likely to include widespread job losses and a move to concentrate on more fuel-efficient vehicles.
Barack Obama addressed the 99th annual NAACP conference in Cincinnati last night. He said he'd insist on more accountability by Washington and Wall Street, but that African Americans must also lead by example.
We've got to demand more responsibility from Washington. We've got to push aside those special interests and let the voices of the American people ring out. But you know what? We also have to demand more from ourselves.
Obama told the gathered that he promised to keep talking about responsibility issues.
The Senate Banking Committee will get the latest on the U.S. economy this morning, including plans to crack down on shady mortgage deals and the rescue of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke and Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson are scheduled to testify.
On the campaign trail, Barack Obama delivers a major policy address on Iraq and national security in Washington, D.C. This morning, John McCain holds a town hall meeting in Albuquerque before heading to St. Louis. Certainly on the minds of GM will be the price of oil this morning spiking above $146 a barrel. U.S. markets closed down yesterday, and Asian and European markets are way down this morning. The Hong Kong Hang Seng fell 4%. The Nikkei lost 2%. European markets are down midday. So our question today is, what is your torture playlist? We already have some responses.
Andrea Richin from White Plains, New York. Anything by the Carpenters.
Oh, man, what is your playlist? We don't want to make fun of torture, but bad music played over and over again is an effective tool for mind control. It's well known in radio and elsewhere. You can reach us at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
And we know you have an opinion, so give us a call, 877-8-MY-TAKE.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com. The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. It is Tuesday, July 15th. It looks like, John, we've hit a button following published reports that the CIA sometimes uses songs to force detainees to talk. And already we've got some buzz on our website. Bruno wrote to us and he said, these will make anyone confess to the Lindbergh kidnapping. Fly, Robin, fly by Silver Convention.
That's so special bad.
For extra tough nuts to crack. Metal Machine Music, any album, sighed Lou Reed. We want to hear what your thoughts are
Lou
on
Reed.
This. 877-8-MY-TAKE.
Not Lou Reed.
We're going to move on to politics. We're going to take a slice of what's happening today. Some responses from Senator Barack Obama's appearance last night at the 99th annual NAACP conference in Cincinnati. First, let's hear a bit of that speech.
We've got to demand more responsibility from Washington. We've got to push aside those special interests and let the voices of the American people ring out. But you know what? We also have to demand more from ourselves. I know there's some who've been saying I've been too tough talking about responsibility. NAACP, I'm here to report. I'm not going to stop talking about it.
Now, Barack Obama was talking to an audience that was well aware of the dust-up last week over comments made by civil rights leader Jesse Jackson, in which Jackson accused Obama of talking down to black people. For the most part, Obama, though, gave a standard stump speech where he covered issues that affect all Americans, health care, education, the economy. Joining us is Essence Magazine senior editor Patrick Henry Bass. Good morning, Patrick.
Good morning, Adore and John.
Morning, Patrick.
What was the significance, if any, of Obama's speech in front of the NAACP, do you think, Patrick?
Oh, it was huge because it's showing a sea change within the NAACP, which has been very, very reluctant to change for many, many years.
Sea change in what sense?
A sea change. And first of all, Ben Jealous is the 35-year-old leader of the NAACP. And that type of message about personal responsibility, I mean, it just wouldn't have been heard 10 years ago. Bruce Gordon, who is a telecommunications executive, was trying to move the needle forward with the NAACP just 2 years ago and sadly resigned after, you know, a real rocky, I think even less than a year leadership role there. Because some people in the NAACP just aren't ready for that type of message. And what we're seeing with Barack Obama and Patrick Duvall and Cory Booker and some younger African-American leaders, Hal Ford, is that the baby boom African-American message that was carried by Jesse Jackson and Reverend Al Sharpton, that's out of lockstep with what I really believe is a silent majority within the African-American community who are demanding more in terms of our leaders.
So essentially you're talking about two things here. One is a generational shift in terms of what the new national black leadership looks like, and two, just the specifics of the parallels between Ben Jealous, who was a 35-year-old, now leading the NAACP, and there was some real tension among the board members in giving him that job, some of the similar kind of pushback that Barack Obama has seen and felt from older African-American leaders.
That's correct, Adora, but the NAACP, in all fairness, has always had a contentious board, you know, from its very founding in 1909. I mean, people should read the new Ida B. Wells book by Paula Giddings, where Ida B. Wells Barnett walked away from the NAACP even before it could get started. You know, so it's always had that rocky history, and anytime you have 64 people on a board, you know, coming together to try to make decisions, you're going to have some rocky moments.
And how relevant is the NAACP, do you think, today?
I'm sorry, what did you say?
How relevant do you think the NAACP is today to the African-American community?
Well, it's an important voice, you know, because there's not been a rival organization that, you know, has had the, you know, leadership and effectiveness that the NAACP has had. I mean, so many of our great leaders have come from the NAACP, and Ben Jealous is actually a step in the right direction towards the future. There are debates about how many people are, you know, registered with the NAACP, whether it's 350,000, whether it's 500,000, but it still very much means something to have that NAACP card.
Patrick, how much of this conversation, which it sounds like is to a certain extent internal within the black community, relevant to the broad national debate that's going on with all groups in the United States, is there a tension between the internal, external, or is it really, you know, immaterial at this point?
Well, I think it's more internal, external, but I have to say to you that Bill Cosby 2 years ago went on a tour and talked about personal responsibility within the African-American community and was, you know, was booed, I mean, which would never happen to America's father. At the Essence Music Festival over the 4th of July, he gave that same type of message and had a standing ovation of 6,000 people. I think that what African-Americans are doing is looking inwardly and making some, we're realizing now that some of the choices that we've made over several generations are not working.
Patrick Henry Bass. Thank you, Patrick Henry Bass, senior editor for Essence and our friend, a takeaway contributor.
Absolutely. It shows just how much is changing in the electorate on so many levels. This election is going to be so important. A couple of responses. We teed up in the last hour that we want to hear your luck rituals. What is it that makes you lucky? What thing do you do to keep bad luck from taking you down? Marsha wrote on our website, if you find a coin, it's bad luck to pick it up. If heads are down, my friend Regina put that in my head, and I've passed up several coins opinions over the year. After all, why take a chance? We have many more torture songs coming up. We're going to get to those later on in the hour. But first, within the hour, General Motors is coming out with more restructuring measures today, taking a look at its entire business. We teed up that was going to be happening last week with our friend Stephen Dubner. Well, now we're going to see what GM thinks of as putting its entire business on the line. Chairman and CEO Rick Wagoner is going to discuss the changes at a news conference. Jamie Butters from the Detroit Free Press joins us from Ferndale, Michigan. Jamie, what is Rick Wagoner likely to present that will reassure people? I guess the top question is, are you bankrupt, Rick?
Well, he's going to say no. That's going to be the main thing he wants to get across to people, is that they're not bankrupt and they're not going bankrupt. You know, bankruptcy is a function of cash, right? Do you have the cash on hand to pay your bills when they come due? And so he's going to have to show that they're cutting costs, that they're continuing to cut costs. But I think he's also going to have to offer some I would really hope that he's going to be able to say we've secured some source of financing. We've got some line of credit or a new investor that if we get into trouble next year, if there's another bump in the economy, we can withstand that and get to 2010 when the cost savings from the UAW contract kick in and good new products get on
the road.
This is a
real sea change. They can't, it's really clear from what you're saying, that they can't just announce some cost savings and have the stock price go up and sort of make the balance sheet work that way. On the cost savings front, are brands on the line? Are they going to ditch Buick? Are they going to ditch Hummer? What do you think?
Well, they've said that Hummer's for sale, and if they can get anything for it, that would be a nice thing for them. They've got a good ride out of Hummer, but clearly it's a brand that's completely out of step with the times. It's sort of, some would say, like the pet rock, you know, of autos. It was this great hot fad, and it's over. So if they can get anything for that, that'll be great. Maybe there's somebody who wants to buy their way into the U.S. market and would do that. But Buick is the volume brand and the prestige brand for GM in China, which is really its second most important market. So that would be hard to get rid of. The others, all of their brands, you know, part of the problem GM has had over the years is the cars aren't different enough between the brands. And they're just so – they've gotten maybe better about that, but they're so closely integrated, it would be really difficult. Who's going to buy Pontiac anyway? I mean, if some Indian automaker or Chinese automaker wanted to buy Pontiac or GMC to get into the U.S. market, you know, GM either can give them all their names, sell them just the names, in which case they're not going to get a lot for it, or they can try to sell them all these vehicles, which is handing over the blueprints to basically all of their Cadillacs and Chevrolets.
That we are even talking this way is an absolute sort of, 10 on the Richter scale as far as the auto industry is concerned right now. Talk to me about what workers listening to this news conference need to be thinking about as Rick Wagoner lays out the terms of this restructuring.
Well, obviously, they need to think about their own situations and their own options and opportunities. I expect we're going to see a broad buyout offer made. They've already cut the white-collar workforce from about 44,000 U.S. salaried workers when I got here to Detroit in 2000, down to 32,000, 33,000 now. So they already chip away 1,000 or 2,000 at a time. They're going to take a bigger chunk out. They're going to make offers. If they don't get enough, they'll probably have to turn to severance, involuntary job cuts. At GM, they're looking down the road at their colleagues at Ford, many of whom passed up buyout opportunities, and now Ford is looking at involuntary cuts by the end of the month.
Wow.
Lots
to tee up, and we will know what the details are in less than an hour at this point. Jamie Butters, thanks for joining us.
You bet, anytime.
Jamie is a reporter at the Detroit Free Press, speaking with us from Ferndale, Michigan. Wow, that's
every
amazing.
Every week, and none of it sounds good, really.
No. Plant
or perhaps
closings,
it does
buyouts.
Sound good. We'll see how the market reacts.
Yeah, we'll see how the market reacts.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253. Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everybody. What is luck? We're asking for your luck rituals at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Of course, luck is that ethereal karmic pal looking out for you when you roll the dice or scratch off that lottery ticket or anything like that. It's also kind of a feeling, right, Clint?
I know what you're thinking. Did he fire six shots or only five? Well, to tell you the truth, in all this excitement, I've kind of lost track myself. But Ian, this is a .44 Magnum, the most powerful handgun in the world, and would blow your head clean off. You've got to ask yourself one question. Do I feel lucky? Well, do you, punk?
Whether you're a punk or not, you probably ask yourself if you feel lucky almost every single day. The Chinese are concerned enough about luck that they are making sure the Olympics start on the luckiest day perhaps this century, August 8th, 2008, 8808. The number 8 is lucky for the Chinese. And all that has motivated us to bring in Kevin Kwan and Deborah Aronson. They're the authors of a new book called Luck, The Essential Guide. And guys, it's great that you're here, but to write this book, I gather you have to buy into this idea that there is such a thing as luck. Right, Deborah?
Well, yeah, and more people than probably most people think actually believe in luck. There have been a lot of studies done about what's called magical thinking, people's belief that they can affect the outcome of events that they actually have nothing to do with. For example, when they're sitting on their couch watching a football game, you actually think if you're sitting in the right seat or wearing the right shirt that that's actually going to have an impact on the way the game turns out.
And all the investment in higher education for both of you by your families and your parents, and you write a book on luck, right, Kevin?
Totally out the
you're
door.
You're totally in there. Yeah, okay. So let's talk about the story that I want you to tell the origin of that's perhaps the most obscure is in Sweden, if you walk on a manhole cover that has the letter K on it, really bad.
Because, see, K in the U.S. is not necessarily a good letter.
Well, and manhole covers. I mean, what's the origin of that story? And why did the Swedes believe that that's the case?
It's really about what K stands for and what K can sound like. For example, you know, K stands for love. So if you're standing on a K manhole cover, you're supposed to think of the one you love. And people tend to kiss on the manhole cover, you know, they skip over the manhole cover, things like that. The one you're really not supposed to stand on is the one with the A.
Oh, the A is the unlucky one.
K is lucky.
And according to your book, the K on the manhole cover actually stands for the word...
Karlak. I'm probably mispronouncing this completely.
Karlak or Kalvatten, fresh water.
Exactly.
But, the K standing for luck is why it's lucky.
Exactly. Whereas A is avlop, which is sewage. But can also
well, of course that would
mean
be unlucky.
You know, yeah. Can also mean avbruten, which means broken love, or avsjuka, envy, and other bad A things.
The All-Star Game is tonight, and of course, if you have a proclivity for one team or the other, National League or American League, or if you're trying to get your team through the playoffs, people will go through all kinds of rituals to make sure that their team makes it. What do you not do to your team to keep from jinxing it?
The worst thing that you can do is to actually assume that the outcome is finished before it's done. So it's bad luck to either praise something that someone has done, what a great hit that was, or we totally have it sealed. We're definitely going to win now. We're home free. Anything like that is
leaving the stadium really bad.
Exactly. Right. All of that is really jinxing your luck.
Why does turning your underwear inside out correct bad luck, something you've done for bad luck? If you want a quick corrective step, turning your underwear inside out actually works.
It's actually, there are a lot of superstitions actually around underwear, but in particular, that's really thought that you can change your life and really make kind of a lucky U-turn by reversing your underwear. The same is true for spinning around in a clockwise direction. It's also thought to sort of reverse whatever bad energy you've got going.
It's like knock on wood. It's a sort of a corrective. Oh, I did something, you knock on wood, you sort of correct it.
Exactly. Well, with knock on wood, it's actually the super superstition is that that gods lived in trees and that knocking on wood would either bring out the good luck gods to protect your luck. If you had said something like, oh, I did really well on that exam, well, you want to knock on wood so that the luck gods come out and they protect that and let you hold on to that.
Let's talk about these luck gods in a moment. In the back of the book, there's stuff that's really unlucky, like stepping on a crack, which, of course, you know, right, Adora? I mean, stepping
it'll
on a crack.
Break your mother's back.
But bread. All kinds of unlucky things happen with bread. Explain, Kevin.
Bread is unlucky because, I mean, based on how you turn it, how it lands on the table, things like that, how it's sliced.
If you burn bread, done.
Very unlucky.
Forget
exactly.
It.
Just
leaving a knife stuck in bread.
Really?
Very bad luck.
But this list gets really long. I mean, at a certain point, as we were talking about before you got here, you don't leave the house. And the flip side of that is some people would say when good things happen to you, it's really about faith. Right, that they believe in whatever God it is, whether it's Buddha or Jesus Christ or whatever that is, that the more observant you are, the more lucky, the more likely you are for things to work out for you.
Well, there's, I think, a really interesting and sort of shifting line between superstition, luck, faith, belief that the power of positive thinking, the belief that by thinking good thoughts you can positively affect the outcome of things.
Oprah.
And yeah, and I think that's kind of a sliding scale, and different people sort of situate themselves and their beliefs along that spectrum.
And where are you? I mean, are you in the, like, I have faith because it couldn't hurt, or do you actually believe in the luck gods? You've invoked them a couple of times here.
I have to say that as I've worked on this book and read about it more, that I have certainly developed a few of my own superstitions.
I mean, writing this book would make you neurotic in the extreme, Kevin. I mean, I wouldn't even, again, Adora said we wouldn't leave the house. I read this, if I adopted all of these...
I don't even want to tell you about my morning ritual getting here, what it took, and the 25 things I had to do before I came up on the air.
Kevin Kwan and Deborah Aronson, co-authors of Luck, The Essential Guide. What is your luck ritual? Call us at 877-8-MIND-TAKE. Femi, okay, you have the headlines.
Yes, I do. 28 minutes past the hour. Lawyers for a Canadian prisoner held at Guantanamo Bay have released 10 minutes of a 7-hour videotape of his interrogation. It's the first video of interrogations at the prison. It shows the suspect, 16-year-old Omar Kudar, distraught and crying when being questioned about being tortured.
I lost my eyes. I lost my feet, everything.
No, you still have your eyes, and your feet are still at the end of your legs.
Omar is accused of throwing a grenade that killed a U.S. soldier during a 2002 firefight in Afghanistan. The UN says it's pulling non-essential staff out of its Darfur region in Sudan. It's a precaution against a retaliation for the ICC call for the arrest of Sudan's president on charges of genocide. And the ACLU says the US terrorism watch list has 400,000 people on it, more than a million when you add up the aliases. The organization says that's just too many to be effective. Almost sounds like a gag, doesn't it?
It's too many security cams. Mm-hmm. 400,000 on the watch list.
Yeah.
Oh, for heaven's sakes. Are you on the list?
Ben? I hope not.
Thank you.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, now featuring Father's Day, a short film about a woman whose father left her when she was a child, and her daughter, who now wants to meet her estranged grandfather, if he lives long enough. Available at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everybody. In advance of a news conference out of Detroit by General Motors, we understand that GM will suspend its dividend to weather the downturn, also speed factory closings and cut salary job costs, the details within the hour. Adora?
Turkish police are on the hunt today for nearly 40 people they believe were involved in a plot to overthrow the government. They've already arrested 48. The mystery and intrigue comes at a time when the ruling Islamic Justice and Development Party is facing a very serious constitutional challenge. To look at all the angles with us is Bulent Ali Riza. He's a senior associate at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, the director of their Turkey project. Bulent, there are a range of people reportedly involved in this plot. Have the government officials, like the two ex-generals accused in the plot, have they been charged?
Good morning. The two ex-generals have not been charged yet, and potentially, if and when they are, that will be the most important aspect of the current investigation. And secondly, the Ankara Chamber of Commerce president was released. So what we have is a situation in which 86 people, of whom 48 are in custody and 38 are at large, have been charged with trying to overthrow the government, a very serious charge, and it's the first time in Turkish history, Turkish political history, that this is happening. And the fact that you have a broad range of people from all the areas of activity that you mentioned makes it a very interesting case with the outcome by no means certain.
And what exactly are they accused of planning?
A coup, no less. Involvement in and incitement of a coup in one form or another. Now, Turkey is a country that has had four coups, all of which have had the powerful Turkish military involved in one form or another. And this is the first time that that the judicial system is being asked to look into what is a very serious charge, and if they find the evidence, and yesterday an indictment over 2,000 pages was released, to be punished accordingly, and that's a very significant development.
Now, the timing of this roundup of those allegedly involved in a coup plot comes when there is a separate case that's really gotten a lot of attention in Turkey, where you're talking about the Justice and Development Party accused of introducing religion into the government, and people feel very strongly about that line between the secular and the religious in Turkey. Is this a real possibility that the court will rule against the ruling party?
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, this is a case that's been going on since March 14th when the prosecutor alleged that the ruling party, which it won elections just a few months before with almost half the votes, was undermining the fundamental secular nature of the republic. It's a very serious charge because it suggests that this party is taking Turkey away from secularism and from its commitment to Western ideals to a state based on the Sharia. The ruling party has denied it in its own defense to the court. But given the composition of the court, which has 11 members, eight of whom were appointed by the previous president, many of whom were appointed by the previous president, it looks very likely that it will decide to close the party down. But that's not going to be the end of the story because the voters who voted for this particular party...
45% of the population.
47, actually, or almost. And that's, as I said, nearly half the voters. And when they get the chance, and when a ballot box is put in front of them with perhaps a successor party to the JDP, they will almost certainly vote for it again.
Well, when they get the chance is really the key here. I mean, in Turkey, you have two things, a passionate tradition of this argument between religious authority and secular authority, and the Constitution explicitly calls for a secular authority in Turkey. How is this different, and going back to the alleged coup plot for a moment, how is this different than the moments in Turkish history where the military has taken back power from the democratic institutions and people marched in the street cheering? There's a certain kind of impatience with democracy in Turkey, isn't there? What's changed?
We'll find out what exactly has changed. But the last time that this happened was 10 years ago when the military indirectly pushed out an Islamist-led government. Now, 10 years on, we still have the same struggle between those who believe that that you have to maintain the secular system, whatever the cost, and those who say the people have spoken, This is a democratically elected government that's won two successive elections. And as long as it stays within certain lines, it ought to be allowed to govern. Well, Turkey's got a tradition of coups by the Turkish military, which from the moment of its creation by a general, Mustafa Kemal Atatürk, has seen itself as the guardian of the system. And whatever happens in the closure case, this struggle is going to continue. And the fact that there are two ex-generals...
Just finish your thought there, sorry.
No, what I was going to say is that the fact that there are two ex-generals, two four-star generals, no less, part of the sweep that has put so many people in jail draws attention to the role of the Turkish military in the system. And the biggest question out there is, how exactly is the Turkish military going to react if the party is not closed down? And related to that is, how is it going to react to two of its top members being tried for a coup?
Finally, very quickly, because we just have a few seconds here, do all of these issues point to a country that's unstable or just a country struggling with democracy and what it means?
Both. Turkey is less stable than it was before the closure case was opened and before the current indictments were laid at the door of these 86 people.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it is still a democratic country. And even if it's interrupted, I believe that the democratic system will return. But one hopes that they will be resolved peacefully without any kind of upheaval of the kind that we had before.
Bulent Ali Riza, thank you. He is a senior associate at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, director of their Turkey project. And now we have some news from Femi Okay. Femi?
Hello there. It's 20 minutes to the hour. Just getting this news in from the Labour Department. And we've seen wholesale prices jumping by 1.8% last month. That's the biggest one-month rise since last November. The Labour Department is saying that soaring costs for gasoline and food have pushed up the inflation at the wholesale level. And now to some other headlines. The Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke is giving lawmakers an update on the economy this morning when he testifies before the Senate Banking Committee. Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson and other top economic officials will also appear before the panel. The CEO of General Motors is expected to make a major cost-cutting plan just about 20 minutes from now. It's expected to include widespread job losses. The Pope is in Australia. He sent a text message to the pilgrims in Australia. The message said, "Good day, pilgrims."
Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Adora Udoji.
And no, we don't think terror or torture is funny here on The Takeaway, but certainly it's piqued your curiosity, the idea that you have a playlist, a misery playlist. Irving wrote on our website, "William Shatner's tortured version of Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds is perfect for torturing prisoners. One is the loneliest number, according to Cheryl, or in the year 2025. And listen to this song. Babylon by David Gray.
Okay.
It was a hit.
Yeah, I know. I like the
song.
You
recognize it, right?
I like the song.
According to published CIA reports, it tops the list at Guantanamo and other U.S. prisons in Iraq as part of a PSYOPs program to break detainees. What does David Gray think of that?
It doesn't matter what the music is. It could be Tchaikovsky's Finest, or it could be Barney the Dinosaur. It really doesn't matter. It's going to drive you completely nuts.
So is it the song itself or is it the repetition? Dan, listening online to The Takeaway in Cleveland, says two words, chicken dance. Jack says, torture, I'm not so sure. We used to use song repetition to haze pledges back in college. We had two favorite songs for this, Cars by Gary Newman and Tom's Diner by Suzanne Vega.
Oh, that's a good one. Pete says, we're surprised you didn't mention this classic torture tune from the film A Clockwork Orange, where the main character is forced to listen to Beethoven's Ninth over and over and over again. There are, on the torture playlist that was compiled by Mother Jones Magazine, a number of songs that you would naturally expect to be on, like this one. I knocked you in on There's Metallica.
Right. I believe that.
Okay, that I can see some wincing in your face. But, you know, equally popular among interrogators is this familiar song. What do you think of this?
Oh.
Yeah, see,
Sesame Street?
No pain there. Big smile. Big smile from Adora. That's, of course, the theme from Sesame Street. But let's raise the anxiety level here a little bit.
Oh, God.
I love you.
Not a sigh of pleasure there from Adora Udoshi. No. As David Gray suggested, the theme from Barney is one of the popular songs that PsyOps interrogators use. So we've been asking you for your misery playlist, and our friend Cortez weighed in with this.
Hey, guys. Torturous songs. Can't remember the name of the artist, but from the 70s. We had joy. We had fun. We had seasons in the sun. I'm about to throw up right now. My name's Cortez. Take care.
Terry Jacks is the name of the artist there.
The lyrics, they sort of stick to your brain. They're very sticky, as our executive producer, our SVP, Dean, would say.
Do Ray's here.
The song that I hate the most is Raindrops Are Falling on My Head by Engelbert Humperdinck. This is Ray calling from Levittown. Raindrops
keep falling on my head. That is an actual torture, right? Dropping water on your head?
Well, I think the actual act of doing that might be torture. Listening to the song, I don't know.
And then here's another one. See if you can recognize this caller or this artist.
Good morning. My name is Dan, and I'm contributing the torture song of You Light Up My Life.
That's a good one, man. Do you know the artist? One-hit wonder.
I don't know.
Debbie Boone.
But these are songs that are supposed to bring you joy. This is an upbeat song about bringing joy.
The misguided artistry. Billy, Don't Be a Hero. Some other suggestion on our website. The Night Chicago Died and Seasons in the Sun. Man, this is great. Keep sending your torture playlist to us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. I'm turning Japanese. I don't know. That's what I can say.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everybody. Quickly, inflation, according to the Labor Department, is up more than a full percentage point in the monthly number. And 10 minutes from now, General Motors is going to give us details of its restructuring measure.
Also today, another spike in oil prices. They're trading somewhere around $146 a barrel. President Bush has handed congressional Democrats a challenge. Speaking of oil, yesterday he lifted an executive ban on the controversial issue of offshore drilling. Now, the lift has no power on its own because Congress must also lift the ban in what's called a two-key system, but the move is intended to put Democrats on the hot seat.
All that remains is for the Democratic leaders in Congress to allow a vote. The American people are watching the numbers climb higher and higher at the pump, and they're waiting to see what the Congress will do.
And for more right now, we're turning to Carola Hoyos, Financial Times chief energy correspondent, and she's coming to us from London. Good morning, Carola.
Good morning.
Now, this is really one thorny issue. Let's start with the reality. What is President Bush proposing, and is there agreement among experts that offshore drilling will actually help oil prices?
Well, let's be clear. Pretty much nothing is going to happen after this proposal. As you've mentioned, Congress still has to move on it. But it is relatively significant. People do think that more oil can come from these areas that are closed off. It's part of the coastline on the east and on the west coast and parts of the U.S. Gulf of Mexico. The question is really in many experts' minds whether this is the best move to make if you want to increase energy security and if you want to decrease prices. And on prices, you know, it's not insignificant. Yes, the oil won't flow for another 10 years because it takes a long time to look for oil, drill for oil, and then actually produce it. But the market will take into consideration the fact that there will be more access. But really, it's a drop in the bucket. So I don't, people filling up their tanks this summer are not going to feel a difference. So that's kind of the quick take and analysis of it.
Politically speaking, I mean, the House Majority Leader Nancy Pelosi called it a hoax. Is President Bush really putting Democrats on the hot seat, though, because there seems to be some growing support for this idea of offshore drilling, particularly when people are feeling the pinch right now?
Well, I think he has put them on the hot seat, but I think wrongly so. You cannot drill yourself out of the situation we're in, and in fact, it's worse than a hoax. I think one of the problems that you've been seeing in the U.S. in particular, but in elsewhere as well, is that politicians are going for the easiest ways out, even if they're not a good idea. They're talking about tax holidays. They're talking about blaming speculators. They're not talking about the hard stuff, the stuff that is more difficult to sell to voters. And I'd argue that, in fact, it won't be so hard to sell. I think they're judging the voters incorrectly. What this does, and this is why I think it's worse than a hoax, is that it delays the debate that the U.S. needs to have on using energy more efficiently and really bringing its energy policy up to par with Europe and then maybe even further with Japan. That will make a big difference. Talking about drilling is a good idea and fundamentally, theoretically, could make a difference, but will have a very, very bad effect overall if it delays the real debate that needs to be happening.
Well, Carola, let me take the Bush position for just a moment. I mean, let's look globally for a moment. What if, forgetting U.S. politics for a moment, if the global sentiment is let's look for oil that's hard to get? At $140 barrel oil, we can find a lot of stuff that wouldn't have even tempted us before. Does that begin over time within this decade to have an effect on oil supply and ultimately price? Does that provide a tipping point going forward? And what would be the counterargument? Can you deliver an equivalent kind of counterargument on demand and conservation that will reduce the price in any sense?
Well, you've hit the nail on the head. The issue isn't one of access, and it's not only an issue of access within the U.S., it's an issue of access around the world. And as parts of the world are shut to investments, companies that we know, the ExxonMobils, the Royal Dutch Shells, the BPs, the Total of France, are going to places like Canada, to the tar sands that weren't economic at $40 oil, but really are now. That has serious environmental consequences, by the way. That's a mining project. That's not easy oil, as you mentioned. Another area is the Orinoco Belt in Venezuela that has similarly extra heavy crude oil. We're venturing in Norway into the Arctic Circle. Further down the line, the U.S. Geological Survey is looking to try and figure out just how much oil there is in the Arctic, in the deep, far-off Arctic. Now, technologically, it's going to be very, very hard to get out there. There's still a lot of ice and a lot of problems there. So that's not for kind of a decade onwards, and it's a bit of a pipe dream. But people are talking about it. The Russians, in fact, planted a flag last year on the seabed. And so politically, the movements are starting there. The Brazilians found a big deposit off their shores. We're moving into the very, very deep water of the U.S. Gulf of Mexico in areas that the industry really couldn't have drilled in a while back, probably about 10, 15 years ago, because they didn't have the technology. That's here now, and it's economical. And then, unfortunately, we're also moving into areas, or not we, but the Chinese, the Malaysians, and others are moving into very fraught areas in terms of human rights. They're moving into
countries
like Sudan.
So there's a real rush. So there's a real rush, Carola, because there's some real money to be made. Carola Hoyas, thank you.
Thanks.
Carola Hoyas is the Financial Times chief energy correspondent based in London, and she's becoming one of our pals here at The Takeaway.
And it's interesting how this focuses the issue of, do you go for conservation or demand issues, or do you focus on supply? It's a giant turning point. You can do one or the other, but you can't just sort of stay on the fence indefinitely. I think that's what she's
saying.
Seems
like a real catastrophic clash, actually.
Yeah. Well, if you want to get catastrophic clashes out of your brain and get some relief, tonight you could watch the All-Star Game. That's what's going to be happening at Yankee Stadium. It'll be the last All-Star game at the old Yankee Stadium. The Yanks are going to move to their expensive new home next year. But the matchup, which is supposed to be the best of the best, is it still the all-star game that we've come to know and love as, you know, young kids growing up, the Mickey Bantle all-star game? The Takeaway sports correspondent Dave Zirin joins us from Baltimore. Dave, what do you make of this all-star game? And let's postpone the issue of the last Yankee Stadium for a moment. We had the Minnesota Twins ace last night winning the home run derby. What do you look forward to tonight?
Well, I don't look forward to a lot. I mean, over the last 11 All-Star games, the American League is 10-0-1 in those games. So we're not exactly talking about a level playing field when it comes to the American League versus the National League. This year might be a little different in that regard, in that several members of the American League starting lineup, real staples like Ichiro Suzuki, Derek Jeter, Manny Ramirez, are hardly having All-Star seasons, so maybe that'll reflect itself somewhat. But as you said, I don't think people are going to be tuning in tonight to see the game itself. And frankly, I don't think people have for years tuned in to see the game itself. Tonight's about Yankee Stadium. That's the real bell of the ball tonight.
Is the stadium encouraging players to actually play hard in this game, where perhaps last year or the year before they'd be concerned about injuries and affecting their multimillion-dollar contracts?
Well, that's one of the big contradictions of the All-Star game, because for years it's been a situation where managers have been very, very, let's just say, tentative about pushing players to play their hardest, about pushing pitchers, because if they do it to their own players, well, then they feel like they're risking the second half of the season. If they do it to other players, there's a history of other managers and other executives giving them a lot of guff about ruining their team's chances. But at the same time, there's a contradiction there between this being a friendly exhibition where every team gets a player on the roster and it's all la-la-la and kumbaya, because at the same time, the winning team gets home field advantage in
right.
the World Series.
Not a lot of kumbaya. Well, David, if something crazy happens tomorrow night, we'll give you a call and have you on the show tomorrow. Do you have a song that represents torture in your mind, a top 40 hit before we go?
Sure. Torture?
Yeah.
The song Torture by the Jacksons when they reunited in the 1980s.
Beautiful. Dave Zirin.
Torture!
Thank you, Dave. Dave Zirin, our Takeaway Sports contributor. Speaking of torture, the Labor Department issued the wholesale price rate for this month. It's up 1.2% month to month, but year to year, 9.2%. That's the fastest rate in 27 years. Try that for misery. Take any responses you have to our show, you can send to us at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
And here's a response to some more music that tortures you, because, boy, have we gotten a lot.
Hi, this is Steve from close to New Jersey, and the number one torture song on my list, and please don't hold this against me, is MacArthur Park, a truly toxic piece of music.
Melting in the dark, all the sweet green icing flowing down.
That's
yes.
scary.
Someone
that you know the
left the cake out in the rain. I don't know.
Okay.
Lots more on our website. Read a piece called When the Scary Becomes the Stupid, Obama Satire in the New Yorker. Adora?
And here's the takeaway from this hour.
So if you're standing on a K manhole cover, you're supposed to think of the one you love.
Or we have David Zirin's La 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 Kumbaya. You ever quite heard that?
Never
all
had
in one
the
sentence?
Recipe again. Okay, anyway, that is the takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Adora Udoji.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.